Welcome to Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. I'm Sean Crawford. Ahead, it's been a busy time for the solar industry, but the skies are still a bit cloudy for the future. A federal tax credit that has helped convince many to install solar is expiring. We'll hear more about it. This year marked the 100th anniversary of what was the deadliest tornado outbreak in U.S. history. It's become known as the Tri-State Tornado. The author of a book on the topic will give us more details. The end of cash bail in Illinois has been controversial. We'll find out how it's worked in one county. An international student talks about life on a visa. Also, the National Organization for Women, or NOW, has a new leader. She grew up in Illinois, and we'll talk with her. And also, we lost a giant in Illinois government this year, former Governor Jim Edgar. We remember him. Those stories and more coming up on Statewide. You're listening to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. This year marked the 100th anniversary of what's become known as the Tri-State Tornado. As the name implies, the storm began in southeast Missouri. It moved through southern Illinois into southern Indiana. It's been widely studied as the deadliest tornado in U.S. history, killing nearly 700 people, injuring more than 2,000. Angela Mason became fascinated with the Tri-State Tornado in the early 1980s. She wrote a piece for a local newspaper where she worked, but in the late 90s, she traveled through the area, interviewing survivors of that storm, many who were just children at the time. Those firsthand accounts are the basis for her book, Death Rides the Sky. She talked with us about it. What was the day like for people when this storm moved through? Was there any evidence that severe weather was possibly on its way?
No, to a person, and I interviewed 54 survivors, to a person, they were all saying the only thing that was a standout about that day was that it was warm. March 18th, you know, right before spring, some of the folks that I spoke with, they had parents that were very weather-wise farmers. And the farmers said, you know, the air felt close and muggy. And that generally was a warning that they might get storms, but they had no idea the magnitude of what was coming out.
And of course, we did not have the warning systems that we have today.
Where it dropped in Missouri, what they saw around them basically were mountains and trees. See, it was the foothills of the Ozarks. So you really couldn't tell what was coming up unless it was right overhead, right on top of you. And I've been out there and they're absolutely right. If you're in the hills and hollers, you can't see what's happening. So it dropped there in Ellington at what is believed to be an EF3 and then moved on through there. So these folks could kind of feel there was a change in the atmosphere as it got closer, but they didn't know what was happening until it was right on them.
Now, it's called a Tri-State Tornado. It has been historically, but is it clear if it was one tornado? It's most likely, from what I've read, possibly different tornadoes that were formed?
My weather guys that I interviewed, including the late Chuck Doswell, who's just a weather genius, in my opinion, he believed the reports that from the individuals in there and in my book that indicated that there were three vortices within one big vortex. So imagine one great big giant tornado rotating. And within that rotation, there are three other smaller tornadoes rotating. He has all kinds of speculation as to how that could happen. But the survey tracks and the eyewitness reports indicate such a thing. Now, they didn't see three tornadoes until Griffin, Indiana. But a lot of my little old ladies, I'm going to call them because it was all of them, that were pointing out, and they each said something different about how it felt when it moved over. They would say the air got close three times. Or one of the ladies said it was like whoosh, 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 and then it was gone. So they described this three gust phenomenon.
Let's talk about the people that you did speak with who witnessed this tornado. Some were very young at the time, and probably, you know, had some memory of it, but I think you said, you told me before, maybe got a lot of the gaps filled in from their parents and others through the years. But others were more aware. They were late teens, 20 years old when this happened, and you spoke with these people. Give us a few of the stories that really stood out to you.
I would have to say the singular story that still gets to me, and it's difficult even for me to talk about, and that came out of DeSoto, which is in Jackson County, outside of Murfreesboro. And that would be Lala Bridges. Her name was Lillian Buller. Her little sisters called her Lala, so I call her Lala. And she was 16 at the time. Her mother was going to watch a neighbor woman who was about to give birth. I guess her mother was kind of like a midwife. And Lala being 16, and then her little sister Lola, and then her baby sister Ruby, who was only 3 months old, were all going over to this gal's house for the baby's birth. And the storm was approaching. Lala's uncle, his name was Sam, worked over in the rail there in DeSoto. She's not sure if the rail house in Murfreesboro was able to get a telegram over to Sam, or if he just saw that cloud coming up on the hill. But he went running down the street yelling, and he pounded on the door there at Lala's house, and he said, if you get to Grandma Tippy's basement right now, you're probably going to make it through this, but you need to go right now. And Lala's mom said, no, I can't. I have to help with this baby. And so he was running up and down the street telling everybody, well, here came the tornado. And Lala was holding on to her baby sister. And the tornado pulled her out of the front window of this house and above the trees. And I asked her, what did you see when you were up there? And she said, I'm not really sure. She said it was just trees whipping back and forth below me. And then she lost the baby. She lost hold of the baby and went crashing down into the street. That just, I had a three-year-old child at the time. Most of that chapter was written with her on my lap. It was just heartbreaking.
I'm guessing a lot of folks had similar remembrances of this, that they, maybe even some of their first memories.
It's possible, because I don't know that anybody ever told me that, but yeah, that's a very strong possibility. And the thing about it is, every story that I chose, there was some element of it that was like Lala's. It was just so tragic, and you could hear it in their voice, you could see it in their eyes. They were reliving it. And this is something that I later learned, really. Because when I was 19 and I said, why hasn't anybody ever written a lot about this story? Well, those folks didn't want to talk. We're talking 50 years hence, they still didn't want to talk. They were traumatized. And by the time I came around in 1999 and 2000 and 2001, almost every other one would say, I'm at the end of my life. I might as well talk to you about it. And so we would sit for hours and have coffee or tea, and I would hold their hands. They got it out. They got the story out. And some of them even said, well, you got this out of me. I hadn't talked to anybody about this in so long, or maybe even ever. That was kind of a success. It's kind of an odd success, but it was, to get these folks to talk about it, because they were so traumatized.
Did they seem to have, and I've seen this happen in other situations with bad storms, they get a fear of storms. Did you notice that from those folks, that they were fearful of any time a dark cloud came on the horizon, that would be something that followed them the rest of their life?
Absolutely. Mary Bell Melvin, one of the most lovely ladies I've ever met over in Murfreesboro. You'd look at her and you would think, oh, she's so polished and refined. But when a dark cloud came up, she would just kind of lose it. She said, I would just kind of go into a trance. She was so traumatized. She was the one who told me that from the fires in Murfreesboro, after the tornado came, a second disaster came, a second wave of disaster, which were the fires And she said, I can still hear those screams of people dying in the fires. And it happened all night, overnight, the 18th into the 19th. They weren't very far away from the fires. And she could hear them as an 8-year-old child. So when a bad storm would blow up, she would just almost freeze. There was one that came through Murfreesboro in 1957, almost on the exact same track. And her daughter was with her at the time, and her daughter actually had to physically take her hand and lead her downstairs into the basement so they could be safe in case that tornado came anywhere near her. So yes, it was a lifetime for these people.
I know that there have been storms in the past that have damaged schools, students at the schools, very concerned community after something like that happens. That happened in this storm as well. The kids were in school and it hit more than one of them, right?
Yeah, it seemed like the little schoolhouses and also the big schoolhouses. There was a 3-story one in DeSoto that was new. It was maybe 10 years old. It seemed like they were magnets for this. And over in Missouri, even too, little one-room schoolhouses got it. But you have to think about how many one-room schoolhouses were actually on the landscape at the time. There were a lot of them. And these children, many of them were harmed in the collapse of their schools in Gorham, in Murfreesboro, in DeSoto, in Parrish. There were a lot of injuries.
How did the towns recover, or did some fail to recover after this storm?
Some did not. I can tell you that Parrish is just like a grouping of houses now, whereas it used to be a viable town, post office, store, feed mill, that kind of thing. There were buildings there in 1999 when I went to find survivors that have since been torn down, but they were ancient buildings. A lot of them were sway back, but there were ancient buildings when I was there. But Murfreesboro is one of the saddest stories because they were an up and coming place. They had a lot of industry at the time, and they were really set to be a wonderful, big moving economy there. And the tornado took that out. It took out the GM&O roundhouse where they worked on the rail cars. They decided not to relocate or, rebuild there. They relocated elsewhere. So it wrecked Murfreesboro economy at the time. Did a lot of damage to West Frankfort because the mines. This storm was so vicious and the winds so massive that it rolled full coal cars, just rolled them and wrecked the tipples, wrecked so much mining equipment at Orient outside of West Frankfort. They did rebuild, but you have to think about what that was doing to the immediate economy. It wasn't farm season yet. It was coming up. People were planting, but there was a lot of economic problems that stemmed from this.
This would have been a damaging tornado. You just alluded to its strength. Even if the warning systems we have today were in place, this would have been unthinkable damage. However, the loss of life, I'm assuming people think now that if we had more warning and give people more advanced knowledge that this was coming, could have saved hundreds of lives from the storm.
I believe so. There's been a lot of speculation about that. Because of the number of school children that were in the buildings that couldn't withstand that kind of load, there were so many child deaths. In DeSoto, of the 69 dead, 38 were children. So if there had been any kind of warning system, they could have taken cover. As it was, many of them were actually caught outside. They were just caught unawares, they were children. You see big black clouds rolling up and you think, oh, it's going to rain. They didn't even call it a tornado back then. They called it a cyclone. And some of those children didn't even know what that was. As far as the tales from the adults, from the people who were adults at the time or teenagers, they were cognizant of the fact that there wasn't any kind of warning system. They told me if we just had something, if we had known that that day was going to be maybe a negative type of weather day, maybe kind of potentially dangerous situation, but they really didn't have that. They didn't have the kind of forecasting we have now, and they had no early alert systems at all.
So, as somebody who's studied this, who's interviewed survivors, what do you think the lesson is from the Tri-State tornado?
I get asked that a lot. There are several, but I think the most important would be prepared. My children were very young when I was going through the interview process and we were driving all over three states. They went with me. They heard the stories too. And they were kind of scared. And I'm like, we don't need to be scared. We have a basement. Let's have a plan. So we would actually practice tornado drills. And sure enough, we had one go right like down our street that same year. And everything went fine. The kids got in the basement. They even had a hold of the cat. They were ready to go and they were not scared. And that's a big thing. You cannot prepare in fear. You have to prepare when things are calm and when you can think rationally. So I think that's probably the biggest takeaway from the book. But the other thing that I want people to know is that history does die. As your older senior citizens, as they die off, their stories are dying with them. If they didn't write them down, nobody else did, they're gone. What can we learn from our elders? This is something that we really put a lot of effort into this book, is that we want people to know everybody's story is important. I tell people we could probably write a book about every single person, every single one that went through this storm. You have to kind of filter it down when you're going for publication, but these people are valid. They have stories. They went through something that hopefully will never happen again. We need to preserve those stories, but also know the kind of spirit that it takes to come back.
Angela Mason is author of Death Rides the Sky. It features stories of survivors from the Tri-State tornado. The deadly storm moved through southeast Missouri, southern Illinois, and southern Indiana. It's considered the deadliest tornado in U.S. history. We'll talk solar power on Statewide. That's coming up. We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. A federal tax credit for solar runs out at the end of the month after Congress voted to eliminate it. People in the solar industry remain optimistic, but as Rachel Kramer reports for Harvest Public Media, homeowners are rushing to complete projects before time runs out.
Hi, girls. Rhonda McClure and her husband toss a few pumpkins over the fence to their flock of sheep on a small farm in Wahoo, Nebraska. In one of their grazing areas, there's a row of shiny panels tilted toward the sun. They added a solar array in 2021 to help power their home and well. Rhonda says solar fits in with her efforts to use sustainable practices and reduce their energy costs over the long run.
Several months, our overall bill has been like $4 or $9.
Those cost savings helped convince the McClures to install other solar projects on their farm. That includes new solar panels for an outbuilding where Rhonda stores wool, makes fiber art, and hosts visitors.
We already have church groups and school groups come in, and now in the future we'll be able to add, you know, yeah, you can come here during the summertime and have an air-conditioned space because of the solar.
But Rhonda says they likely would have waited to install this solar until next spring if it weren't for a federal tax credit expiring earlier than expected. Originally, homeowners had until the end of 2032 to qualify for the Residential Clean Energy Credit, which covers 30% of project costs. The One Big Beautiful Bill that became law in July cut that deadline to the end of this year.
That caused a kind of a run on solar here.
That's Eric Schneider, Director of Business Development at Straight Up Solar. The company designs and installs solar systems for homes, businesses, and nonprofits in Missouri and Illinois.
We sold out in September, and many other solar companies were selling out in July, which means their entire build schedule was full for 2025 because people wanted to get in before the tax credit expired at the end of the year.
In Iowa, customers are also looking to install projects before the end of the year. Paul Cutting helps homeowners identify opportunities to improve their energy efficiency and pay for them as an energy auditor with the nonprofit Clean Energy Districts of Iowa. He sees solar as something that will continue to attract more homeowners concerned about rising electricity bills, even without the federal tax credit next year.
I imagine there's going to be a slowdown, but I think solar at this point probably has a lot to stand on its own.
Electricity rates across the U.S. have gone up in the last 5 years. Inflation, upgrades to aging infrastructure, and natural disasters are some of the factors. The rapid expansion of data centers is another. Corey Zeman is a solar program coordinator with the Midwest Renewable Energy Association.
We're hoping that maybe people start looking at their bill and they realize solar is still a good investment because energy prices are going up. And if you're buying solar, you're essentially buying all the energy you're going to use from that system all at once. You're locking in that rate, so you won't be subject to the increases that are coming.
The cost of installing residential solar varies a lot. Nationwide, it averages around $23,000, according to the nonprofit Center for Sustainable Energy. But industry experts say some residential solar projects can cost upwards of $40,000. Zeman says the federal tax credit made it more affordable for homeowners to install solar. But another way to help cut costs is through something called group buys.
And a group buy is essentially getting a large group of people together in a certain community and then going out to bid and trying to get people a bulk price so that they can all go solar at once.
Zeman's Grow Solar team has completed over 70 group buy programs across 6 states in the Midwest. He's optimistic about solar's future. So is Schneider with a solar company in Missouri and Illinois, who says the industry has always been dynamic.
We call it the solar coaster in the industry because demand kind of fluctuates up and down and up and down, and some of it's policy driven, some of it's interest rate driven.
Schneider and others in the solar industry say they're along for the ride. I'm Rachel Kramer, Harvest Public Media.
2 years after the landmark criminal justice reform removed cash bail in Illinois, advocates celebrated the end of a pay-to-play system that kept people in jail simply for a lack of money. Critics said cashless bail would lead to more crime and more missed court dates. As with most things, the truth lies somewhere in the middle. Eric Stock talked with the reporter Lauren Warnicki of WGLT in Bloomington Normal. She's been following the end of cash bail and the specific effects in one county, McLean.
So give us the broad strokes. What do we know about the impact of eliminating cash bail in Illinois?
The Pretrial Fairness Act, or the PFA, had the potential to impact courts and jails the most. And McLean County Jail saw a steep drop-off in occupancy right at the start of the PFA in September 2023. Sheriff Matt Lane recently told WGLT occupancy was around the 150s per day in late 2023. And since then, the population has kind of steadily crept back up and now actually exceeds pre-PFA levels. Sheriff Lane says they're now hovering around 230 to 240 beds filled on any given day.
So wait a minute now. Advocates had said that the end of cash bail was going to reduce the jail population. Now it's going up. Has crime gotten worse or why?
Yeah, not necessarily related to crime. Frank Beck is a sociologist with Illinois State University's Stevenson Center, which tracks trends in the McLean County justice system. Despite some saying crime rates would balloon under cashless bail, he says,
there is no indication of that. I mean, as far as I know, the number of bookings on new charges has not increased.
But Beck says his data shows arrest warrants are up, and that's in large part due to defendants who violate the terms of their pretrial release.
I don't think that's an increase in crime. I think that that is persons who were not detained, who were released. They were given a notice to appear, court dates, and they missed the court date, and then there's a warrant for their arrests.
Now, what's the reaction from law enforcement to this?
Sheriff Lane agrees with everything Frank Beck is saying much of the jail population that's new is there because of a sanction or a pretrial release violation. So people charged with non-detainable offenses then violate the terms of their release and wind up back in jail. Lane says a large proportion of those cases are drug charges.
when there is no bond and they're released immediately on a notice to appear for, say, a drug charge, there's no break in the drug usage, I think, is a little bit of the problem. And so they're immediately back to it, and they continue to miss court, whereas if they were held at least for a short amount of time and to see the judge to set a bond and then come up with a bond, that sometimes gives them a break.
And, you know, we can say that the sheriff's probably like partially right here. Data from the office, the statewide office of pretrial services, which manages both pretrial investigations and monitors pretrial release, say since the beginning of the Pretrial Fairness Act in 2023, 94% of all people enrolled in these pretrial release services in McLean County do show up for court. Although that doesn't include necessarily people who are immediately released without a hearing. And this data also does not stratify the information by charge, for example. Sheriff Lane says he thinks judges and prosecutors really deserve more agency in deciding who should and shouldn't stay in jail.
My opinion is that if you have local judges who know their community and know the issues, and you take decisions out of their hands, that's detrimental to your community. They should have the opportunity to apply their knowledge and their expertise to know when somebody should be held or not.
Now, in previous interviews, McLean County's top prosecutor, State's Attorney Erica Reynolds, agrees with Lane, saying cash bail effectively takes away too much discretion from the courts. Though more often than not, when she filed a petition to have a defendant detained, she wins. The statewide office of pretrial services says that her success rate is around 68%, and Reynolds did decline to comment for this story in particular.
Now, President Trump recently weighed in on cashless bail. He issued an executive order trying to create a blanket federal ban and said the counties that defy the order could risk losing federal funding. So what are officials in McLean County saying about that?
Sheriff Matt Lane says he was not aware of any specific guidance about this order. And remember, the county is just following state law here, so it doesn't really matter what Sheriff Lane's personal opinions are about cashless bail. The sheriff says he doesn't anticipate the order will lead to any changes. McLean County Chief Judge Casey Costigan told WGLT in a statement the court's job is to simply apply the law as written, and cashless bail has been litigated in Illinois and been found to be constitutional. So the judge essentially bows out of any opinion on cash bail, saying it's the job of the legislature to write and modify the law. But he also says, quote, "We would, however, be deeply disappointed by any cuts to federal funding that supports programs designed to assist individuals in need, prevent crime, and reduce recidivism."
Now, is there any way to track which defendants are more likely to violate pretrial release and miss their hearing?
Yeah, again, the answer here is sort of. I said earlier that 6% of court dates among those enrolled in pretrial services were missed. So the critical question is, who is that 6% that's missing court? Sheriff Lane blamed drug charges, since people in active addiction are more likely to show up in court if they're held in jail. When pressed, Sheriff Lane says methamphetamine is the primary problem, and that actually tracks with the data. In the Stevenson Institute data at ISU that tracks McLean County in particular, missed court appearances for drug charges did not significantly change under the Pretrial Fairness Act, despite changes in the legal code about drug charges being able to be detained or not. The exception is meth charges, in which absence from court has increased pretty dramatically.
All right, so what else do we know?
Well, there's another trend that the Stevenson Center is tracking that kind of runs in parallel, though it's not directly related to cashless bail. But it is contributing to this steady increase in the jail population. Frank Beck from ISU notes that half of detainees now have some kind of mental health condition. So that's an increase of more than 20% over the last decade. And it does not include substance use disorders related to drugs or alcohol, though those often occur together.
So what is the reason for that change?
So again, there's not simply one cause to the change. It could be because there's more awareness and better reporting of mental health conditions, both through a combination of self-reporting and symptoms or behavioral concerns noticed by police at booking or guards at the jail. But Frank Beck from the Stevenson Center says the central issue is actually systemic.
There's a fundamental problem with persons who have a mental health issue, who are in the jail, who are set to be sent to a state facility for their own, you know, that's how it's adjudicated, and that's how it's, you know, for their benefit. There's no beds. And so they're staying in McLean County longer because the state can't take them.
This is something that Sheriff Lane has corroborated.
Lauren, thank you for your reporting.
It's my pleasure.
Lauren Warnicki reporting on the end of cash bail in Illinois. It's been over 2 years now since that law took effect. The National Organization for Women has a new president who grew up in Western Illinois and was involved with the state chapter of NOW for many years. Rich Egger tells us about her.
When a parent is a political science professor, you just might find yourself discussing politics at home. That was the case for Kim Villanueva as she grew up in Macomb. Her father, A.B. Villanueva, taught political science at Western Illinois University for 30 years.
I remember when I was little, the Watergate hearings were going on.
The family would watch those hearings on TV and then talk about what was happening. She says their member of Congress at the time was Republican Tom Railsback, who was on the House committee that was investigating Watergate.
So that was sort of brought it home for me that, you know, what happens outside in the big world comes back into this little small town of Macomb.
Villanueva says even though Macomb is a small town, it was pretty cosmopolitan because of the university.
There was quite a diverse student body, and my dad's colleagues in the department were from different political perspectives, but they were also geographically diverse and from different countries.
Her father brought some of that geographical diversity to the department. He immigrated to the U.S. from the Philippines. Kim Villanueva went on to study journalism at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign in the early 1980s. That's also where she became involved with NOW. It started with a journalism class assignment. Students had to come up with their own beat and report stories about it. So she created the Women's Issues beat. Her professor was not sold on it initially.
He was a little skeptical, but I think he admitted that I did find topics to write about. You know, women were just starting to get in the workforce, and so I would write stories about women who had to find childcare so they could work.
As part of the class, Villanueva talked to some women from NOW about the Illinois legislature's failure to ratify the Equal Rights Amendment. The women encouraged her to attend a NOW meeting. After graduating and moving to Springfield, Villanueva sought out the local NOW chapter and has been involved with the organization ever since. She believes progress has been made on women's issues during her lifetime, but is concerned some of that progress is being rolled back.
I think we're seeing recent Supreme Court decisions, you know, the Dobbs decision, you know, moving the right to abortion back to the states was a huge blow for women and women's health care.
While Villanueva has concerns on the national level, she says Illinois has made advances on pay equity, family leave, and child care issues. She says Illinois was also ahead of the curve on passing marriage equality laws. As NOW's national president, Villanueva says she will work to raise awareness of issues such as reproductive health and stopping violence against women, and they want to amplify those issues in red states such as Indiana. Villanueva was in Indiana recently for the 46th annual Valparaiso Popcorn Festival. She says people cheered and waved to the NOW contingent as they marched in the festival's parade.
So we're just trying to get out and say, you know, you may not identify as a feminist, but if you agree with equal rights and that women should be paid equally and that they should have the right to control their bodies, then you are a feminist. That's what it's all about.
Villanueva says growing up in Macomb gave her a common sense perspective. She says it helped her realize that it's good just to sit down and talk to people. Even if you disagree, you need to be willing to listen. Villanueva says she's respectful of others' opinions, but will stand her ground when she needs to. Rich Egger reporting.
The stress many international students are feeling, that story is just ahead on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. It's been a stressful year for many international college students. The Trump administration is canceling visas, rewriting rules, monitoring the students' social media. Peter Medlin sat down with a Northern Illinois University student from Nigeria to talk about life on a visa.
In the fall of 2023, the semester was in full swing, the weather was getting cold, and Babatola Arugundade was more stressed than ever.
I was missing home, I was struggling with food, then the weather became cold, I was struggling with the weather.
He thought about quitting. Mental health struggles are common for international students, and to make matters worse, Tola came to the U.S. to study mental health. He's a doctoral student at NIU's Counselor Education and Supervision Program. Tola wanted to study in the U.S. to build bridges, to connect Western counseling theories and techniques with African psychological principles, but all he could do that fall was keep his head above water. It was his first time in the U.S., and it was a grueling visa process just to get here.
You know, you go to an embassy in Nigeria, U.S. embassy, and you see over 5,000 people there applying for visa. How many are going to get approved? Maybe 100.
But he says the challenges start way before you enter the embassy. First, you have to apply to a school, interview, and get accepted.
Then, not all admission comes with full funding.
Can you pay tuition and fees? It's especially tough when over 60% of Nigerians are multidimensionally poor, meaning they experience poverty across several indicators like health and living conditions. And Tola was accepted at NIU, but he says he was initially only offered a 10-hour per week graduate assistantship, even though he was eligible for 20 hours. And without a full scholarship, he had to raise nearly $20,000 to prove to the embassy he could pay for college.
I started soliciting for money to borrow from different families, different friends, to ensure I have the sufficient amount. It wasn't easy.
It took 2 months, and then he had to secure an interview at the embassy.
But in Nigeria, it's more like a sport. It's like a competition.
He created a WhatsApp group with other students, taking turns watching the website day and night in case an open appointment pops up. It can take days or weeks, and Tola didn't have much time.
We are kind of religious back home, so people pray.
Finally, a date came up, July 5th, and he got it. And in the meantime, he got even more good news. The university could now offer the full 20-hour graduate assistantship, and that means he didn't need to borrow as much money, and that raised his approval odds. But now he also had to update key documents, and it took days of calls and emails, and he got it just in time for his interview.
I was scared. It's between either yes or no. And interview at the consular is less than a minute.
Why are you studying in the U.S.? How are you paying for school? He rehearsed his answers because he knew just one stutter could cost him. And thankfully, he was confident. He says he saw the interviewer reach for the white approval paper as he answered, and it was a massive relief. But now he only had a few weeks to get a passport, book a flight, find an apartment in DeKalb, and say goodbye to his family.
So I left Nigeria July 30. Then I entered 31st. Then I resumed work August 1st. So there was like no rest for me.
A few months in, he was exhausted. He thought about transferring or quitting. International students are held to a high standard. GPA minimums, full class loads, only working in jobs related to your field. It's difficult, especially as you're adjusting to a new school and a new country. And his first semester seeing clients in the U.S. showed him how hard it would be to build bridges between Western and African approaches.
I remember when my supervisor at the place came and talked to my professor here about the kind of approach I'm using, more like as if I'm not competent enough. Then I remember them calling me at my department trying to talk about, oh, you know, what kind of struggle am I going through? That period, actually, I felt a bit betrayed.
He says he'd always get assigned black clients, and there was a misconception that because he's black, that they had the same experiences, even though he's not African-American, he's African.
The first year was really, really tough, and it ignited my research.
That project was understanding the supervision experience of Black counselors with multiple minority identities. You can be Black and an international student, or Black and disabled, and Tola says all of those identities intersect and should be acknowledged in supervision. And he earned a grant to fund that research in 2024, and Tola says he found his participants were forced to do a lot of extra labor.
Over explaining to their supervisor about their identity and also try to protect themselves from their supervisor, and also protecting their client from their supervisor, because once you can't trust your supervisor regarding certain things, you want to protect your client.
He's now expanding that research for his dissertation and expanding beyond just Black counselors to all counselors with multiple minority identities. And Tola also recently received an award from the Illinois Counselor Educators and Supervisors Organization. And while he's personally settled in at NIU over the past 2 years, life on a student visa has become more and more challenging. This year, the Trump administration revoked, then reinstated, scores of student visas across the country, including several at NIU. And the administration said it would review all 55 million visa holders for potential violations, and they're also vetting social media accounts. All that led to international enrollment falling 20% at NIU this fall. Provost Lori Ellis-Piper said some students were unable to get their visas in time to start the semester, and more visas are now subject to additional review called administrative processing, which can take months. And Tola says he knows several international students with full-ride scholarships who were denied after administrative processing.
They don't tell you why you had been denied. That is the frustrating part. So you don't know, maybe you have put something on your social media 10 years ago. You don't know.
Even if you're approved, processing delays could cost you a spot in a program or a GA position. Rule changes have also affected Tola personally. His initial visa was for 2 years.
Most African countries, they don't give 2 years visa anymore. Let me use my country as a case study. Now they give 3 months visa.
The new short visas also only allow a single entry. So if you leave the country, whether for vacation or university research, it invalidates your visa and you have to start all over. And with all of those new changes, he wonders if he could have even made it to NIU if he was going through that process now.
I don't think I would have that luck.
He says it makes him sad because he sees how much international students contribute to their schools and the economy. Tola knows a lot of students who live in fear that their visas could get ripped away at any moment.
I don't live with fear. That's the only way. I'm not just on that surviving mode. I'm in the living mode. Life comes at us very fast. Policies will come. I try to still stay optimistic.
He hopes to graduate within a year and eventually return to Nigeria to keep building bridges between cultures and break down the barriers that keep people from getting the help they need. I'm Peter Medlin.
Former Governor Jim Edgar died earlier this year. And even though he was a Republican, he received a lot of praise from many Democrats. Governor J.B. Pritzker called Edgar a model public servant, and the Democratic House Speaker Emanuel Chris Welch described him as a, quote, damn good governor. Before his death, Edgar spent almost 3 hours talking with Dave McKinney from WBEZ about his life and legacy, his cancer battle, and a Republican Party under Donald Trump he said he no longer recognized.
Late last year, Edgar wanted to check in his blood sugar. The results came back fine, but something seemed off about his liver. The last thing he expected to hear is a lifelong teetotaler. Edgar's doctor ordered further testing.
So I went in and got the MRI, and it was New Year's Eve. He called me and said, it's not good. He says, it looks like you've got cancer in the pancreas and the liver.
There'd been no pain or any other warning signs. That diagnosis was a total accident. In the weeks and months that followed, with the multiple rounds of chemotherapy, there was a strong sense that this cancer maybe had been caught early. Yes, his stamina, appetite, and always well-groomed head of hair suffered during treatments, but in our conversation last spring, he sounded like the Edgar I knew from my days in Springfield covering him in the 1990s.
How has it altered your life up to this point?
Oh, huge. I mean, that's all I think about.
In April and again in May, we spent some time talking on the phone. The first call lasted close to an hour, the second one close to 2 hours, and none of it ever aired. We chatted not only about the day's political events, but also his life's work.
I think what I'm the most proud of are people said he was good.
As governor, Edgar made adoptions a priority and tried to narrow the gap between rich and poor public school systems. He launched a plan to pay down the state's gargantuan pension obligations, and he left office with a $1.5 billion budget surplus. Edgar was one of the last statewide Republicans who brought downstate and suburbia together for a winning coalition. He favored gun control and abortion rights and was a big reason Republicans controlled the governor's mansion for 26 straight years between the late 1970s and early 2000s. And what he did in 1994, getting reelected by winning 101 of the state's 102 counties, still stands as one of the most dominant political performances by a statewide candidate in Illinois history. Only Gallatin County in far southeastern Illinois prevented a clean sweep, and there he lost by only 3 votes.
And I'm still mad about Gallatin County, those 3 votes. I mean, to the day I die, I'll be mad about that.
Edgar grew up in downstate Charleston. His dad died in an automobile crash when Edgar was 7. He developed his taste for politics around that age. Even though he grew up in a Democratic home, he got his first grade class in a mock election to vote for Republican Dwight Eisenhower in a school-wide presidential vote.
I knew that Eisenhower was the Army general. And any red-blooded, I said, 6-year-old in 1952, when he ran, would be for the Army general. That's kind of why I was for Eisenhower.
Edgar loved growing up in a small downstate college town. And as a student at Eastern Illinois University, he met his wife of 58 years, Brenda. She was the future mom to their 2 kids, and from the start, his political door knocker. She hit up every one of her classmates in her college dorm to vote for Edgar for student body president. He wound up winning, and after the votes were counted,
she went to her room, and on her door was, "Congratulations, EIU First Lady." And she got a kick out of that. Now, that's what she'd have been happy if I'd have stopped there.
But he didn't. His passion for politics lasted a lifetime. Though in his final years, his passion for the grand old party had begun to fade. Edgar told me the GOP these days under Donald Trump tilts too far to the right.
I still vote in the Republican primary.
Okay.
And one of the reasons I vote in the Republican primary, I want to vote against Trump twice.
When we talked last spring, he was gravely concerned about the country's future under Trump.
I think his job has been terrible. And I mean, I'm probably irrational about Trump, how bad I think he is. But I think that he is so far disrupted about every fabric of American life in a negative way. I worry for this country because I don't know what's going to stop him. I mean, it's obvious that Congress is inept. Courts, I'm not sure. And he's got 3.5 years to go. So
closer to home, Edgar didn't have the same harsh assessment for Illinois' billionaire Democratic governor, Pritzker. The two first met when they both were on the board of directors for an online horse racing betting company, and Pritzker left a good impression.
With all that kind of money, you can be pretty cocky, but he wasn't. It struck me he just was very level-headed. And so when he ran for governor, of course, it was after the Rauner fiasco, and we didn't have a budget for almost 3 years. He looked pretty good.
Edgar praised Pritzker for returning fiscal stability to Illinois and for his handling of the COVID-19 pandemic. But he had some trepidation about Pritzker's ongoing dalliance with a 2028 presidential bid.
It's hard to be governor of a state like Illinois and also run for president. And I think that's made it difficult in some ways for him. He spends a lot of time worrying about federal issues, which, you're going to have to if you want to run for president, but maybe you don't have as much time to worry about purely state issues.
Heading to Washington was never on Edgar's radar because he always thought being Illinois governor was a more impactful job in government. But in his political retirement, Edgar still felt the need to contribute. So in 2012, he launched a leadership program aimed at fostering integrity and bipartisanship in emerging political leaders. It's called the Edgar Fellows at the University of Illinois. The program revolved around a set of basic principles: civility, compromise, and compassion. Its alums include House Speaker Chris Welch, House Minority Leader Tony McCombie, and Lieutenant Governor Juliana Stratton. In the call, Edgar reminisced about what one graduate, a Democratic staffer from Chicago, said to her classmates.
She got up and said at the end, "I'd never met a Republican until I came to this program. And they're not so bad after all." Now, she was half kidding, but she had a different impression of Republicans, and Republicans have different impressions of Democrats. I mean, downstaters really have this thing about Chicago Democrats. I mean, they just think they're evil. And, this gave a lot of downstate Republicans a chance to meet Chicago Democrats and found out they didn't have horns. In fact, they found out they agreed on a lot more than they disagreed on.
As my last phone call with Edgar neared its end, he brought up one last thing. He grew up in Coles County downstate, and so did I. In fact, I remember running into him as a kid at a local shopping center. That was about 50 years ago. He was running for state representative then and shook my parents' hands.
I was going to tell you one other thing, being a Coles County guy.
Yeah.
I'm going to be buried in Coles County, and I'm going to be buried by Lincoln. I'm going to be cremated, and I'm going to split the ashes because I couldn't make up my mind.
Some of his ashes will be in a Coles County cemetery with generations of his family. The rest will be in Springfield's Oak Ridge Cemetery, where Abraham Lincoln is buried. Within eyesight of one another, two favorite sons of Central Illinois. Dave McKinney, WBEZ News.
We're out of time for Statewide. Thanks for joining us, and be with us again in the new year. We'll be back with more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. Find us where you get your podcasts through the NPR app and at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.